This weekend starts right after this.
As a business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Strategy for Black Friday. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Before you decide what stores you're going to visit on the day after Thanksgiving, hear the new research from Wallet Hub about the retailers with the biggest discounts.
Millennials have created a new trend as they close on the purchase of their first home. Hear what's now required of real estate agents.
President Trump's recent trip to Asia has meant a boost in business for a small burger joint in Tokyo. We'll explain how.
And the place for wall-to-wall Christmas movies, the Hallmark Channel.
They've been making these kind of corny, romantic, some would say heartwarming holiday movies for a long time. I know going back to the early 2000s, but in 2008 is when the network really seized on this formula and started making more original productions. And since then, they've made 136 Christmas movies.
Wow. Wall Street Journal reporter John Jurgensen on the commitment to Christmas movies by the Hallmark Channel. He's here later in the hour. Well, as the number of mass shootings piles up across the country, more members of Congress find themselves navigating something that's not covered in their freshman orientation. Members whose districts have suffered a mass shooting say they dedicated most of their time in the immediate hours after to relief efforts, like handing out snacks and water to volunteers or visiting victims in the hospital. For many, seeing so much death and raw grief exacted a chilling emotional toll. It's a story from Griffin Connolly, staff writer at Roll Call. Griffin, what have you found?
We wanted to really see what the response was in the immediate for these lawmakers and sort of what the follow-up was too, and how they sort of communicate with each other when someone who's had this happen in their district or state before, what kind of advice they can give to lawmakers who have had something happen recently.
Yeah. Wasn't there one lawmaker sort of put together like a little three-page booklet on questions to ask or things to say or do?
That's right. Yeah. That was Ed Perlmutter from Colorado. So he is actually one of the few lawmakers who has had a mass shooting happen twice in a district or part of his state that's been sort of in his purview. He was a representative in the district adjacent to the Columbine shooting a number of years ago, and also the Aurora shooting that happened just a few years back. And so he put together a memo, sort of a three-page document that sort of outlined what his response was and sort of best practices that he found moving forward for other lawmakers that he shares with people whenever something like this happens.
Wow. Is this just a matter of picking up the phone and saying, hey, I've been there, I've got something for you, here's how I can help?
Yeah, so a number of lawmakers told me that when something like this has happened to them, that they just get a flood of texts and calls from their colleagues, ones that have had something happen in their district and ones who haven't. And some of them even reach out, circle back again to people who've had something like this happen in their district or their state, just for advice on what to do at first. What to sort of do for following up, things of that nature.
Mm. We're speaking with Griffin Connolly, staff writer at Roll Call. He's written a piece entitled Congress's Massacre Caucus, talking about how lawmakers cope with mass shootings in their districts, whether they're experienced lawmakers or not. And this is obviously across political lines, right? I mean, all politics is sort of dropped here. They help each other regardless.
Yeah, absolutely. Gun violence is something that, it kills people. And, obviously I had one lawmaker tell me that, the number one priority of a lawmaker is to make sure that every constituent that they have is healthy and has the means to stay alive, things like that. And that's absolutely something that's bridged across party lines. So everyone is supportive of one another. And I'll tell you a little anecdote, actually. Tim Scott, the senator from South Carolina, was telling me about the impact of some visits that he had from some of his colleagues in the Senate and the House. And he was saying that after the Charleston shooting two summers back where Dylann Roof killed nine people, he was telling me that one of the biggest things that stuck out to him was the visit of Tulsi Gabbard, who practices Hindu, who is a Democrat, Tim Scott is a Republican, who came to a Republican district there in South Carolina and worshipped with Christians who were, you know, mostly Republican or conservative, and who, you know, weren't the same race as her. And he said that was really touching, that someone who's so different would come all the way from across the country, from one coast to the other, to worship with people that she didn't even know.
Wow. You point out, too, in the days that follow these incidents sometimes, like congressional leadership does not step in and indicate what these particular representatives or senators should say, right? They kind of leave them on their own.
That's right. So I was told by one lawmaker that there's really no playbook, that you're not handed a manual, that leadership isn't, you know, gathering with its caucus and telling people, hey, this is how you should react to this, or this is how you should phrase this. This is our messaging. No, that's not really the case. A lot of lawmakers said that they're just acting on instinct, especially in those first few days.
Explain, too, your section there about how the healing continues for years.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was actually a part that definitely came from my interview with Darren Soto, who is a freshman representative from Florida. And Representative Soto told me that something that he sort of came to understand after the Orlando shooting, where he was a state senator at the time, was that something you don't think about, or most people don't think about, is the long-term psychological damage. So being a survivor of one of these horrific incidents where you see this mass carnage all around you, there's psychological and sometimes physical, if you were injured, trauma that is just ongoing and ongoing. And so a lot of times these representatives and their local leaders, you know, like state representatives or senators or whatnot, try to maintain relationships with some of these people.
Thanks, Griffin. Griffin Connolly, staff writer at Roll Call. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
And where is the Gotham Bat? The mass vigilante has been a no-show.
They said the Age of Heroes would never come again.
It has to.
Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 state for business, Michigan. Contact michiganbusiness.org today. Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman joined forces to save the world in the new movie Justice League, out this weekend. But their long-awaited team-up may not be the automatic superhero movie triumph it once seemed. Wall Street Journal film industry reporter Ben Fritz says the release, which gives us the big screen newcomers, Aquaman, Cyborg, and The Flash, has had perhaps the rockiest road to release of any big budget movie this year. Ben, what happened?
Well, this movie had a very rocky road to completion. And it was originally envisioned as sort of the culmination of the first few years of Warner Brothers' DC cinematic universe. You know, there was Man of Steel, then Batman v Superman, Suicide Squad, Wonder Woman, and then the big characters, big superheroes would come together along with some new ones. And, this would be their Avengers. But there have been a lot of problems along the way. The production was very rocky after Batman v Superman was poorly received. They did a lot of rewrites at the last minute to try to make the movie lighter, shorter, easier to watch, not so sort of dark and violent as Batman v Superman was. Then director Zack Snyder had a family tragedy, so Joss Whedon, who directed Avengers for Marvel, took over, did significant reshoots over several weeks. There's been a lot of tinkering to try to put their different sets of scenes together. The budget's gone up to nearly $300 million, very expensive. And that's just the movie itself. There's then the separate issue of, you know, what's happened in the market since then. If you look at the superhero movies that are working these days really well, it's Thor Ragnarok, Warner's own Wonder Woman, the Wolverine movie Logan. These are sort of more, more unique takes on specific characters. They're not so generic, sort of like, you know, if superheroes come together to save the world, people are looking for, I think, more of an auteur's take on a specific superhero, and Justice League is not really that. It's more of a generic standard superhero movie. So it's had a tough road to get here. It comes at an interesting time, and so it's a lot riskier movie for Warner Brothers than I think they expected it to be.
Wow. What about this $300 million cost now? Are they going to get that back, or is it too soon to tell?
I mean, it's too soon to tell, of course, but I think the prospects are pretty good. I mean, the tracking is The tracking is good, and the audience testing recently is good in the U.S. It does seem to me like a movie that would play well overseas. It's a pretty simple plot, very easy to understand, got a lot of big special effects. It's still, you know, is it going to be a $1.5 billion movie like Avengers was for Marvel? That's still tough to say. That would be a... That's a long shot right now, I'd say, honestly. But yeah, I think if Warner Brothers can just get through this and not lose money and not make the critics furious and the hardcore fanboys furious like they did last year with Batman v Superman and Suicide Squad, they'll be happy enough with that, and then they can move on to some future DC movies that are going to be kind of different.
We're speaking with Ben Fritz, Wall Street Journal reporter who covers the film industry. His latest piece is called The Quest to Save the Movie Justice League. I thought your point was interesting about this movie being less serious, more hopeful, one of the changes along the way. How come?
Yeah, I think there's a recognition inside Warner that they sort of, things went astray, and Batman v Superman was just too dark, too negative, and the superheroes were not really people you would admire, which is what they're supposed to be in the comic books. Okay. Same thing is true with Suicide Squad, and the people, you know, there's some new executives in charge of the Warner DC movies, one of whom is an experienced comic book writer, Jeff Johns, and they really feel these superheroes should be more hopeful, more optimistic. That's what superheroes are supposed to stand for. And I think they think that they went astray with they lost that quality in Batman v Superman, and they're trying to get it back.
Wow. How about the Ezra Miller character Flash here that you mentioned? What there's potential for that, I guess?
Yes, I think everybody at Warner who's seen the movie, and I haven't seen the movie, I think it makes sense, you know, believe he's really a breakout character. The other characters are kind of more, let's say, stoic, experienced superheroes, confident. Flash is young, he's inexperienced, he's scared, he kind of masks his fear in humor, and he just stands out. He's very different than I think pretty much any superhero you've seen before. And as I mentioned, I think people seem to like these sort of unusual superheroes who are not just the same old one you've seen before. So that's why I think he's a standout, and why Warner is very eager to get going on a movie featuring just him.
You mentioned, too, that there's this DC film effort called calling 2018 a reset year. What's happening with that?
Yeah. Right. Well, after the Batman v Superman and Suicide Squad reactions were so poor, so negative, and frankly, to be blunt, everybody knows they weren't good movies. DC has sort of rejiggered their plans for future films, and now they were already in the works on Justice League and Wonder Woman, so they went ahead with those, and obviously Wonder Woman was a big success. But after that, you know, they're reorienting, you know, towards, as we discussed, making sure the heroes are more hopeful and optimistic, and they're not worrying so much about the cinematic universe and each movie has to follow each other in the right order. They're just figuring out, like, where do we have directors we like and trust who have really good takes on a character, and the movie's ready, you know, have well cast, and the movie's ready to go, and they kind of don't care what order they come in anymore. They just want to make sure, you know, they're more focused on having unique and interesting and good takes on their characters. They have a huge library of superheroes, and what matters more, they think now, is that the movies are good rather than they all fit together really neatly.
Thanks, Ben. It is Wall Street Journal film industry reporter Ben Fritz. It is 22 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. Thanks for being with us. Not to rain on the parade of the holiday season, but the holidays are a time when you want your home and table to be filled with guests, invited guests, right? It's a time when family and friends may gather in the kitchen for their favorite treats. Unfortunately, uninvited guests, such as pests, can also find their way inside. Here's what to know from Angela Tucker and Steve Cruzy, pest experts at Terminix. Angela, is this problem specific to this time of year?
We usually see sore paw pests year-round, but sometimes at this time of the year, because you have a lot of company that's coming over, they may be bringing food that you're going to put in an area where you might forget about it, like up on the top shelf, or where you're buying a lot of products in bulk and you don't use them all and you store them, then you start having an issue because the pests are inside those products and they're developing, and then you start having a large number of pests. It could be now, it could be a couple of months from now.
Oh, ouch. All right, so what are we most likely to see pest-wise? Ants or other stuff?
Most likely, as far as what we see pest-wise, are going to be stored product insect pests associated with these foods. These are a whole host of small beetles and moths. Very small, so they can be undetected quite easily. They will infest processed foods like flour, pasta, and also whole grains such as beans and rice.
Wow. Is this a regional thing, or do we see this all over the country this time of year?
That's actually a really good question. And this isn't regional. This is actually worldwide. So you can have some pests that are more specific to certain countries just because that is where the pest comes from and is kind of quarantined to that country. But everyone around the world has this issue, and this is actually an issue that we've had for thousands of years where we're trying to store food, and then that same food that we're storing is something that the beetles and the moths are naturally feeding on and or developing inside, and so it's just a competition between us and them, and we, of course, don't want them in our food.
Right. I'm always amazed, like, how do they find this stuff? Like, you know, it's in your cabinet, it's indoors, it's in the kitchen, it's behind the concrete wall. How do they manage to find this stuff?
All right, that is another really great question. So typically what happens is, again, thinking about from the farm to your fork, meaning our food is being grown outside where you have lots of natural insects that are living out there. That's our natural world. And then as we are processing that food and bringing it to our home, into our cabinet, some of those pests come with it either because they were missed during the processing project or also during our inspection of that packaging at home, and then they just kind of grow there. The pests that you have that are coming inside are what's actually living outside your immediate home, but that's typically not sort of product pests because those are very rare outside your house. They've become more attached to our food because it's just easier for them.
Wow. That's not very appetizing, Angela.
It is not.
We're speaking with Angela Tucker and Steve Cousy, pest experts at Terminix, talking about 'tis the season for pests hiding in your pantry. So besides the obvious, like you can see these beetles or ants or other pests, what are other signs, if we don't see the pests, that we might have a problem?
If you don't see the pests, most often it's going to be either small holes that you'll see that they chew through the packaging with the beetles, or with the moths, we have a number of specific types of sort of product pests that way as well. You'll see what looks like spider webbing associated either in your food product itself or on the packaging that gives you an indication there's an infestation.
Thanks, guys. Angela Tucker, Steve Cousy, pest experts at Terminix. It is 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Hey, the holidays are fast approaching. Order gifts for everyone on your list with the click of a mouse. Let me tell you about Omaha Steaks and how for only $49.99, you can get the family gift pack when you go to omahasteaks.com and enter my code DEAL in the search bar. That's 75% off. Omaha Steaks offers the most flavorful, tender-aged beef, aged for 21 days to unlock the full flavors of the cuts, hand-trimmed and vacuum-sealed. They also have veggies, desserts, appetizers, fresh seafood, and so much more. Right now, Omaha Steaks is giving an exclusive savings for our listeners. Listen to everything that you'll get for less than $50. Two filet mignons, two top sirloins, two boneless pork chops, four boneless chicken breasts, four kielbasa sausages, four burgers, four potatoes au gratin, four caramel apple tartlets, one Omaha Steak seasoning packet, plus four additional kielbasa sausages free. Go to omahasteaks.com, enter my code DEAL in the search bar, and get a 75% savings. It's the gift guaranteed to be a hit. Can't get enough Christmas movies? Go to the Hallmark Channel. It has wall-to-wall programming requiring year-round production. 33 new and original holiday films are premiering on two Hallmark channels between October 27 and January 1st, up from 28 new movies last year. More from This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
How do you make a surefire holiday hit? Combine a small town, tree decorating, love, and snow. That's a formula for the Hallmark Channel, which has become a Christmas movie machine. Joining us to talk about it, John Jurgensen of the Wall Street Journal. John, how did this all start and when for the Hallmark Channel?
Well, they've been making these kind of corny, romantic, some would say heartwarming holiday movies for a long time. I know going back to the early 2000s, but in 2008 is when the network really seized on this formula and started making more original productions, and that's when they started ramping things up. So 2008 is when they started, and since then they've made 136 Christmas movies.
Wow. And is 33
this year alone.
Good grief. Is there really a formula? They all pretty similar?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's what they realized. They said, okay, here's a formula that works, and let's just replicate this over and over and over again, and because they really can't seem to get enough. So what they do, they've made enough of these movies that they have basically a giant library of them now, and so they can create this Christmas countdown. So starting around Halloween, they put on all Christmas programming and goes all the way through New Year's, essentially. It's just like when you turn on the radio station that goes to all Christmas music. That's what they do for this network, and it seems to be a huge rating success for them because, you know, people just flip it on and watch the ladies movies over and over and really, I don't know, either whether ironically or genuinely, they seem to really love them.
Well, that's funny because I read some of the comments on your story in the Wall Street Journal, and some of the adjectives were terrible and addicting, happy, boring, heartwarming, sappy. What are they actually about?
Well, they're very earnest. So, yeah, it's kind of a variation on a theme. You know, usually it's it could be a career woman who's overworked and disillusioned with her job and, you know, somehow connects with a rural, earthy guy out in the country who wears flannel and they have a courtship and romance, and there's maybe a secret identity there where one person is, you know, posing as another person. You know, there's lots of different variations on these themes, and, you know, maybe it's a Christmas festival that needs to be saved or a struggling business that needs to be saved. And there's always tree decorating, there's always gift shopping, and there's always snow. And there's always romance. You know, it's often, women finding the love that they thought that was inaccessible to them at a certain point, and, they connect with these guys and happily ever after.
John, your story talks about the producers and what they're looking for throughout the year when they're shooting this kind of a movie. What are they looking for? Where are these movies being shot?
Well, you know, you think about what a Hallmark card looks like, you know, for Christmas, and that's basically what they're trying to replicate on screen. So, you know, a quaint country inn or a rustic barn that is, you know, decorated for a Christmas pageant or a dance. There's always going to be a quaint downtown with, you know, glowing shop windows and the perfect kind of decorations on the trees. Lots of family dinners in front of a roaring fire. You know, pretty much every kind of traditional, some would say cliche, holiday theme you can imagine. But they really kind of lock in this formula. I mean, you talk about Hallmark as one of the most sort of cohesive brands in the world, and that's definitely true of the kind of shows they make and the movies they make that all kind of look like this. So the producers have to, you know, year after year scout these places that have this certain look. And, you know, in certain parts of the country, I guess there's no shortage of them, but when you're making 33 movies a year, you know, you have to, you know, press out and look a little harder sometimes.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal entertainment reporter John Jurgensen. Thanks for being with us. As you map out your strategy for Black Friday next week, here is some insight as to the retailers offering the most aggressive discounts. Wallet Hub has done some research. That's where Jill Gonzalez is a senior analyst. Jill, what'd you look at?
Well, we looked at essentially what the best discounts are going to be by retailer. And unfortunately, they're a little lower than average than years past. We saw 40% on average in 2015, 39% last year. This year, we're down to 37% on average, but there are some stores that almost double that.
Wow. Why the drop?
I think it's really a couple of things. One, we're trying to find the balance between in-store sales and online presence, and that's really been hard to do. There are some retailers like Walmart, Target, that are actually offering different deals in stores, better deals, and trying to really supplement those online sales that we've been seeing boom. So we're now seeing this mix of both.
Wow. Is the expectation that there will be less foot traffic in the stores as we continue to be supporters of e-commerce?
Yeah, absolutely. Less foot traffic year after year. We're seeing less stores even open on Black Friday this year. So it should be very interesting to see if some of these new tactics work or not.
All right, so what do you got? What were some of these retailers offering the good deals?
The best deals this year, it's actually a tie between Kohl's and JCPenney. Their average discount is 66%
wow.
off. That's across categories, so slashing prices by about two-thirds. That's hard to top. Usually it's a place like Sears or Macy's. Those places are still in the top 10, but they've been pushed off the pedestal. Their average discounts is a mere 45 to 50%.
Who's before we get into, I guess, more of the discounters, who's a little stingy this Black Friday?
Stingier places like Costco that typically offer deals all year round. You'll only see about 20% off. Also more specialized stores like a Cabela's or a Bass Pro Shops. Again, only 20 to 25% off.
We're speaking with Jill Gonzalez, senior analyst at Wallet Hub. They've looked at the stores offering the best Black Friday deals. All right, so tops on the list, as you mentioned, Kohl's, JCPenney. Where else are we going to find some bargains?
Other places like Belk, Stage, Sears, Macy's, still in the top here. Amazon actually just narrowly misses the top 10, but surprisingly, still really good deals, just under 37% off. So that 37 number this year is really one to try to hit. Anything less than that might not be a true Black Friday deal.
Wow. And this is in-store we're talking about, right?
In-store or like Amazon, that would be only online.
Yeah. So for Kohl's, for example, that 66.3% discount, is that an average of what you'll see in-store plus online, or is that in-store only?
That's average across the retailer. So okay. In-store, online, kind of a combination of both, and that's across all product categories from apparel and accessories to consumer electronics to toys.
So do you think that we've got a predictable trend here of the discounts getting a little, the average getting a little lower each year?
I think so, because now retailers have to compete all year round. They're not just really honing in on Black Friday or Black Friday season anymore. They have to compete all year round with an Amazon, with a Walmart that's now really doing quick shipping online. So because of that, we might see these deals get a little less so on Black Friday, but maybe better all year round.
All right. You think that, is it Black Friday only? Like if I wander in on Thanksgiving, some of these open stores, can I snag a deal then too?
Some are open, but less than usual. Again, a lot more pushing toward online.
Thanks, Jill. Jill Gonzalez, Senior Analyst at Wallet Hub. It is 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and defense. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. Hey, glad you're with us. As millennials buy homes in greater numbers, new wrinkles are emerging in an age-old process. Gone are the days of popping a champagne cork once the purchase and mortgage forms are signed. Today, more first-time buyers rush to share their newfound status as homeowners across social media. Wall Street Journal reporter Emily Glazer has found that has led some of these buyers to construct elaborate photo shoots in or outside a first home. Emily, what have we learned?
Basically, what we learned is that not only have millennials been buying their first homes, that's been going on for a few years now, but they are obsessed with sharing it and doing it in a really fun way. So they are crafting these elaborate photo shoots in or outside of their first home, anything with hand poses, dancing, piggyback rides through the front door, and then sharing it on Facebook, Instagram, you name it, any social media channel so that their friends and family know they did indeed buy their first home.
All right. So as you mentioned, this can get quite elaborate, but that many times, I guess, involves the real estate agent.
Yes, it was really interesting to find, you know, initially the story idea came about because I was scrolling through my own Facebook feed and saw people I knew, you know, based in cities across the United States, I would say largely smaller cities where it is more affordable to buy a house or an apartment posing. And so after doing some research, there are these Pinterest pages replete with different boards for inspiration of like different poses and different things to do. And there are all these Facebook pages that are run by the real estate agents. So they're using this as a marketing mechanism also. Spoke with people in near Denver, Alabama, Florida, I mean, all over the United States, and the real estate agents realize if they don't bring, you know, take a photo with, even with their phone, it doesn't have to be a fancy camera,
yeah,
like the buyers are usually going to ask. I even spoke with one real estate agent, Corey Maurice Gilmore, who is based in Alabama, and he had such a funny story about how, you know, everyone expects him to take a photo these days after they, you know, sign the paperwork or, you know, even just when they get their key, different sort of momentous moments of buying the house. And he did talk to someone who was really upset more than a year ago. He photographed a couple who bought a house in Madison, Alabama, and the wife quickly texted him after she sent the photo and was like, do not use these photos. Do not post them on Facebook. So he knows now to take at least 10 photos, quickly snapping them on his phone so that the couple will be happy with at least one that he can post.
Wow. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Emily Glazer. She's written a funny piece about how millennials react these days when they buy their first home, specifically when it comes to staging photos of this great achievement. So tell us about this woman who had to dash out for the fake eyelashes.
So one real estate broker, Marvin Martinez, was basically ready to sign with a client right outside of Denver on her first home, and she just would not take the photo because she knew it was going to go up on this Facebook page, and she knew that page at the time, I think it had like 80,000 followers, so it's a lot of people. So they literally delayed the signing by an hour until she returned with the fake eyelashes on and a new outfit. And, you know, Mr. Martinez, the realtor, was like, we just waited. Like, what else could we do? So it's getting a little ridiculous sometimes.
Wow. Real estate agents now have to kind of find that creativity vein, right? Wall Street Journal reporter Emily Glazer. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for being with us. President Trump has been good for at least one small business in Japan. During his recent trip to Asia, he ordered a 100% U.S. Angus beef Colby Jack cheeseburger at Munch's Burger Shack, a tiny shop in Tokyo. The lines out the door during lunchtime have been getting longer than ever, thanks to Mr. Trump. His tough talk on issues like trade and security tend to get a mixed response in Japan, which sees the U.S. as its most important ally and partner. But Mr. Trump's love for the Japanese take on the all-American hamburger is striking a chord with many there, according to the Associated Press. The President Trump Set, a new addition to the menu at Munch's Burger, includes a serving of coleslaw and a side of fries with the cheeseburger and sells for the equivalent of $12. The juicy beef patty comes layered with crisp lettuce, melted cheese, and tomato between hot, soft buns. The owner and chef, Yutaga Yanigasawa, says it has become one of the most popular orders since the president's visit last week. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.